Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The absence of country of origin labeling has had a dramatic impact on cattle prices, and it has a dramatic impact on everything from what's in that hamburger on your plate to the impact on natural resources. Today, as part of SDPB's month-long look at the future of the ag industry, we talk cattle prices with South Dakota ranchers. One of the key questions for you to consider, do you want to know where your meat comes from? BJ Richter and Brett Kenzie join us today on the phone. BJ Richter, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Brett Kenzie, thanks for being here as well.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity.
Before we get into what's happening with cattle prices, tell us a little bit about your operations. BJ, tell us a little bit about what you do on a daily basis.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Well, I'm part of a second-generation farm. My parents ended up buying this place back in the 1970s and managed to survive the 80s. So we are still pretty young in the development of all of these as far as agriculture goes. But generally speaking, you know, we farm. We raise corn, soybeans, grow hay, alfalfa, a number of different forage products. We have a cow-calf herd. We background and we do finish and feed cattle in a feed yard. And we do some custom work along the side, too, to try to keep everything moving in the same direction. So we are fully occupied, as I like to say.
Brett Kenzie, tell us a little bit about your operation, please.
Well, it sounds like I have a similar operation. I'm a fourth-generation operator. I farm with my brother. We have a cow-calf herd. We background. We finish some cattle. We do not grow any grain. 100% of our income comes from cattle.
All right, so let's talk about what's happening to that income. And I want to start with country of origin labeling. A little background, and BJ, maybe you want to start us out, because it was something that disappeared in 2015.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead and just kick us off with an overview, please.
Yeah, sure. And I'll tell you, you know, what I do know. I'm certainly no scholar and no professional in any of these. But as we've seen, this has been a cycle that has happened. As I was a young man running around playing athletics and not paying terrible amount of attention to someone who was fully divested into this industry. And country of origin labeling was something that began in the early 2000s and finally got ramped up and showed its real production early in this decade. So between 2010, 11, 12, it was in the fully implementation mode, 13 and 14. And then we lost it through the help of what I believe is some people within our industry, some lobbying efforts, some World Trade Organization ended up delivering the death knell to it. But essentially what it did is we fought for 15 years to have our product that was born, raised, grown, and processed in this country labeled as a product of the United States. We have since lost that, and the effect, in my estimation, has been quite devastating.
And Brett, it seems like a kind of a common sense thing. You know, I go into the grocery store and I can see on the bag of grapes if it came from Chile or not. Do people want to know where their meat came from in general? What happened? Why did it go away? Is it a lobbying effort and, you know, the economics of the situation that swung?
It's important to remember how profitable the beef industry is. You know, when you look at American agriculture is a large part of our gross domestic product. And within agriculture, beef, I believe, is the largest cash generator in agriculture. So it's very profitable. But you have to realize that there is a lot of competition going on for that profit. And the processors, the packers, had a lot to gain by taking away the consumer's ability and the producer's ability to differentiate American product from imported product. You know, we import 1.8 million head of live animals and over 3 billion pounds of meat from over 20 different countries every year. And that's something that the consumer needs to know. And when they took away cool, the processors gained the ability to switch back and forth between domestic production and imported production to suppress the price of the cattle that they buy, and the consumer is none the wiser.
Right. Now, what you just said is really important. I want to make sure people understand what that looks like as far as what ends up on your plate. So what are the processors able to do as far as mixing things together? Now explain that to me.
Well, I've been told that it can be as much as bringing a live animal from, say, Canada or Mexico as a feeder, finishing it here, and then processing it, it becomes American product. Or it can be as simple as bringing in already processed product from overseas, unwrapping it, throwing that wrapper in the trash, and rewrapping it, and automatically it becomes product of the USA.
All right, let's talk about why we care. So, BJ, some of the investments, tell me in your operation, some of the investments that you have made in order to sort of differentiate your beef from some beef that's coming from other places, so that me as a consumer, if I walk in up to the, you know, up to the counter, I want that product. Why?
Well, absolutely. For a couple of reasons. First of all, in the United States, I mean, we have set, as far as food production standards go, we have set quite a high standard in what we are needing to attain. For instance, you know, there's, if you were to talk to the organic world, for instance, the organic world has much more stringent labeling requirements in order to fit under the umbrella in a product of the United States than importers would be. Let's say, for instance, the you know, that same label would mean something different as an importer coming in from China or from Argentina. Organic does not mean the same label requirements as it does in the United States. So that's the first thing. We have higher standards to attain. But as far as it comes to production, you know, when it looked like we were going to be able to differentiate our product from those frozen animals coming from Argentina, which have historically had a foot and mouth disease problems, or areas, BSE was one that people remember quite emotionally because it was a big deal. But you know, you could not bring any product live animal into the United States during the BSE years. Well, those things have all kind of gone away. So the packers, the producers, or the finishers of the product have been able to use this idea as a being a product of the United States as the umbrella to kind of shelter, or to allow the public to believe that there is nothing different. This has a label on it, says it came from Tyson Foods, which we know is an American company. It has veiled a little bit, you know, who really is on the bottom line production. And we have heard from our consumers, you know, they really do, that they want to know the story. They want to see, they want to be closer to what it is that they are consuming and what they're paying for.
Well, they must, because, you know, if you go there now, there are indications where people say something is an American product. So that really wouldn't show up on the labels at all if they didn't have a sense that that marketing matters. Am I on the right track there, Brett?
Absolutely. The people who are against mandatory country of origin labeling say that people do not care where their food is from. But if that's the case, why do we put product of the USA on all beef sold in this country?
Let's talk a little bit about what has happened to those prices. We've been kind of focusing on, you know, what consumers know and don't know. How big of an impact has this had? BJ, let's talk with you first. What are you seeing? How dramatic is it?
Well, it's hard to quantify just how dramatic it is, because it's been large and widespread. It's been a sweeping loss, in, especially in the feeding industry, for people, for the smaller farmer feeders especially, guys who are not necessarily feeding 10, 20, 30, 100,000 animals in a specific feed yard, who may be a farmer feeder in backgrounding 500 head or 1,000 head. Those guys are really the ones who have lost our market. We've lost nearly 70% of those farmer feeders since the early 90s. That's pretty dramatic, and I think one wouldn't have to struggle hard to draw a comparison to what happened to the hog market in that similar period. It appears to me that at least the feeder side of this is working its way towards vertical integration, not because I think the producers want it that way. It's because we really have lost our ability to market our product with having only four major beef packers in the United States that kill 85% of the cattle. So as far as your original question, the pricing system has been dramatic. The consumer is still paying prices that they were back in 2014 and 15, which were very high. And in those days, we were receiving $1.67 a pound for our animal that we produced. Nowadays, we are, even through this last summer spell here with the fire at the Holcomb plant in Kansas, we're selling cattle under $1 right now. And everybody who's a consumer who's listening to this knows they're paying 3, 4, or 5 times that price just for the lower cuts of beef products, hamburgers, roasts, let alone the premium products. So the real story here is that the consumer has really been taken advantage of, and it's been at the expense of a number of market participants, but it certainly hasn't been at the packer level.
Let's talk about the fire at the Holcomb plant in Kansas, as you brought that up. There was a lot of controversy about what happened to prices immediately after that fire, and even, I believe, some lawsuits coming from that. Brett, can you explain to people who haven't been following that news what exactly the dust-up was?
Well, in early August, a large Tyson plant caught on fire, and they could kill about 6,000 head a day. So that was a large chunk of the processing capacity here in the United States to process cattle. Of course, a panic ensued, but it was very exaggerated. The futures were down the limit a couple days in a row, and when the smoke settled, what it amounted to is we lost $10 to $15 a hundredweight on fat cattle prices. We added $10 or $20 to box beef prices, and when it was all said and done, the packers killed about 9,000 more head that week than they had previous to the fire. So it was just so exaggerated, and a lot of people feel like there may have been some deceitful actions that occurred due to that, and producers were very upset, and for the first time, I believe, enough of them got on the phone and called their elected officials to get the United States Department of Agriculture to launch an investigation through the Packers and Stockyards Act to see if anything illegal occurred.
That story is in the aftermath
of that fire.
Yeah, the story of those allegations still unfolding. And Brett, I want to talk a little bit. I want to go back to something we touched on in the beginning. In my introduction, I talked about natural resources preservation, and we mentioned, cattle coming from different countries with different regulations. Regulations in the U.S. fairly stringent. Talk a little bit about some of the efforts you've made in your operation, Brett, to care for the environment as you do the work that you do that maybe is not happening in other places.
Well, I think that all starts with multi-generational operations. You can't legislate good stewardship into someone's heart. I have been the recipient of generations of hard work, and my ultimate goal is to pass that on to my kids. And I just want to say I eat what I grow, and I live where I grow it. And so I care a lot about this land. And, we've worked with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources to build a containment system around our feedlot so that I'm not having, dirty water running onto my neighbor's ground. We sample our fields for nutrient levels. We sample our manure, and we apply the manure accordingly to grow a crop. We want to do a good job, but it's important. What people need to know is it takes profit to innovate, and it's been so hard in the last few years. We've put in place all of these environmental programs, but they all cost money. And what started out as a lofty goal when we had good profits, we did it in 2008. We built the feedlot, but then in 2014, we had so much money, and we were able to innovate and increase our genetics and do a better job taking care of our environment, plant trees, things like that. But it just becomes hard when you have less and less resources to continue those efforts. Mm. And I think that's a common thread in agriculture. We're learning every day about cover crops and you know, increasing the organic matter of our soil. And now we're learning about carbon sequestration in our soil. And, you know, I think that we all want to leave it better for our kids than we found it. And I think that that's a common theme in agriculture, and especially maybe in family agriculture operations like mine. So,
and BJ, the concept of, yeah, go ahead.
I was just wanted to piggyback on that because I thought that was a very important number of important points you brought up.
Yeah.
But also specifically to animal agriculture, I think people don't often equate how much emotion and care goes into this process. You know, we see these baby calves from the day they're born. You know, you protect them. Your real goal in animal agriculture is not necessarily to see an animal, you know, to its termination point. That isn't where you receive the joy. Your joy is the day that you worked extra hard to save a calf. You got a calf going on its mother. Where you're protected from predators, you're protected from a terrible storm, or the heat in a feed yard was so awful, you had sprinklers and fire trucks out. Those are things that you do. We really spend 99% of our time in the process and caring of animals, and the more difficult the weather becomes, the harder we do work. There's a real joy and a real connection to the life cycle in this business. Now, it's not all about, with that being said, it really isn't all about profit all the time. However, you cannot lose money 15 years in a row, or 10 out of 12, or 5 out of 7. And continue to be as good as you need to be, as you want to be, as you can be. Because our potential and our ability with technology to improve and improve our environment, it becomes easier every year to be able to do those things. But you've got to be profitable in order to be sustainable.
The USMCA trade agreement has not reached the floor of the House, to be passed. But U.S. Senator John Thune talked about it, I believe it was just last week, in a press release that he sent out calling for the importance of getting that done. As I understand it, COOL, or country of origin labeling, is not really part of that trade deal as it stands right now. Brett, is this an opportunity to talk about the situation again with congressional delegates and think about the potential for South Dakota ranchers and operators?
It absolutely is. You know, if you can hear my voice and you live in South Dakota or in this upper Midwest or anywhere in rural America, you depend so much on the profitability of beef producers to support not only themselves and their operations, but the rural communities around them. And if anybody out there can just take a minute to call that congressional switchboard and tell them that you care where your beef comes from, and that you're tired of deceptive labeling, and you know, we need to get country of origin labeling into the USMCA. And the reason it's important to get it done before we enter the agreement is because once we get it in the agreement, then we're no longer subject to the bullying of the World Trade Organization trying to override our sovereign laws, like what happened in 2014 and 15.
BJ Richter, any final thoughts before we let you get back to work?
Oh, well, thank you very much. I just do appreciate the opportunity. And if I could say one quick thing, this is not regarding the beef industry, but there was a young man here from Britain who sustained a pretty serious injury, and he sure could take everybody's prayers and thoughts for him. He's playing football. He's a great young man, a family that's in the beef industry as well, good people. And I just would ask you for your thoughts and prayers.
Thank you so much for that. BJ Richter and Brett Kenzie, we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.